Certification or calendar is 98377, Cincinnati Bar Association versus Timothy Dierdor. Mr. Rosenbaum. Watch your time.
I'd like to start by giving you some early background on Jim that I didn't find his record to be made. Jim is a Cincinnati native, one of 11 children. He went to Xavier University where he was a basketball scholarship athlete. He has had legal aspirations. He in fact ran for the First District Court of Appeal. Much of this is in the record.
This is Mr. Dierdor you're talking about?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
I say to Tim that particularly. He is extremely highly regarded in the legal community. I think that's clear from the testimony of Judge Sunderman. The highest regard for his integrity is, I think, what Judge Sunderman said. Judge Sunderman initially said that he has never known, would never believe that Tim would misrepresent any court or tribunal. I think that's important.
What about Judge, is it Child? The judge that was having the fundraiser, did the judge testify before the panel?
No. There was no evidence produced by either the respondent or the relator, Judge Schweiger. To address that issue, it's clear from the transcript of the hearing before the panel that Tim and Judge Schweiger go back historically at least 11 years together in the municipal court.
But I thought that would be have been important to hear Judge Schweiger's side of it, since there were innuendos that Mr. Dierdor was influencing him, had control of him and all of that.
I believe you hit the key word. The latest case is a case in which his outlines going on. I think it's important to reflect upon Simon Lee's coming forward, former prosecutor of Hamilton County, former judge of the Court of Common Pleas, present sheriff of Hamilton County, and giving his view that Tim is one who is and should be given the highest regard and integrity.
Well, those statements are always fine, except they don't relate directly to the facts in the case and the fact that the panel heard the evidence, saw the whatever testimony there may have been, reviewed the stipulations, and that really is what is before us, is it not? And there's a credibility issue here, isn't there?
Yes, sir.
There seems to be quite a difference in statements by persons who gave evidence.
Yes, that's true.
What's your strongest argument that, aside from the character references, we always see those, but aside from those, what's your strongest, what do you think are the strongest facts in behalf of Mr. Dierdor?
The strongest facts are to me, clearly, Nori St. Paul, the lady that was wired, is a liar. One can't counsel a liar to lie. The tape is what it is. It says what it says. So what this really boils down to, and that's why I'm addressing the issues with Sheriff Lee and Judge Sermon, the character of this person, and what was Tim's intent? Did he knowingly counsel this lady to mislead or create evidence? That's why what Judge Sunderman and Sheriff Lee have said about him might be important, because that's the standard that the relator has to bear clear and convincing evidence that Tim knowingly intended to create misleading evidence. And the best evidence, factually, that Tim had no intention comes from two sources, one being Nori St. Paul on the road to page 310 of the transcript. There is a dialogue between her and I don't remember which particular person was inquiring. You mean that three-way conversation? Yes. Lauren paused. The question, preparatory question was, did Mr. Dierdor at any time suggest to you to change your testimony from what you knew to be the truth? And there's an exchange, and she says, I don't recall who said what, majority in the room was that there were a number of options for me to, including leaving town. So she never indicated that Tim told her to lie. Now, Tim Bureau's testimony that he was on to say, we never counseled her to lie. That's not the goal. The May 23rd taped conversation with Nori St. Paul, page 61, is Hobbs. We don't want you to lie. And so that anybody who has been bitten by a soundbite understands that this is a case of innocence. And I think the context of the entire process is important. And Judge Sunderman hits upon that. The context is a consultation where Tim Dearworth is thrown in blind, basically. Has no history with relation to this lady. She is there as the prosecuting witness in domestic violence of this hospital client.
Counsel, we're really just down, are we not, to the penalty? That's really what we're talking about. The relator wants an indefinite suspension. The board says 1 year, 6 months stayed. Do you think there should be any penalty at all, and if so, what?
If there's to be a penalty, I think the ABA standard decided by Mr. Alton and myself is the appropriate standard that is existing of the permanent. Now, if we have anything that is between a 6 month and a reprimand, because this happens in the privacy of an office, and I think that's a key factor. The privacy of an office, a consultation. I would simply direct the court when we talk about penalty to disciplinary counsel versus Green, a situation where a prosecutor, basically, no polite way to put it, dang the speeding ticket misrepresented a critical fact to the court. This court found a 60-day suspension, actual suspension, was appropriate. With that, I'll reserve.
Counsel, before you sit down, in reading the brief, I had a very difficult time trying to figure out what really happened because your version sounds so different. So I got the tape out, I listened to the tape, and I expect the transcript by listening to the tape. You might even see that Mr. Gerhoff did not know anything about the case when he started, correct? Did not know anything about the case before he started this conversation and it was recorded.
The information he had was on that tape at the outset that there had been some contact, very minimal contact.
So he got her story. Part of her story was related by Hodge. Part of it was related by St. Paul. And up to the point he starts getting advice, that's his whole picture of what he heard from these two women, correct?
Exactly right.
These are his words, not St. Paul's, you say, very lack of credibility. St. Paul, to this point, has never said, I pushed him first. You know what he said? He pushed me first. He hit me. Mr. Bierhoff said, you can say you started the fight. He could claim self-defense. Ms. St. Paul, I started it like I pushed him or something, Mr. Bierhoff. And then what would they do? Would they charge him? That's his word. That's his advice to her to say you started the fight. How can we get around that saying to her, well, you can say you started the fight, when no richer testimony, and she never said that yet?
That's correct. In fact, what she says is that the affidavit she filed with the municipal court was not accurate and that things were incomplete. Yes, that appears on the tape.
Now, she's never said that, though. Up to this point, she's never said that in her tape. When you listen to it, she never said it's incomplete. That comes after he says to her, well, you can say you started it by saying the affidavit is not complete.
And trying to answer your question, Tim's still trying to get to the bottom of what the facts are.
By suggesting she adds some facts?
Or determine whether that fact happened. What did happen, in fact, because if you listen to the tape, I've not had that advantage. I did not handle this through the
You came to oral argument without listening to the tape?
I did. I talked with Mr. Altman, who had the tape. He told me what was on the tape, and I understand what's on that tape. We met and discussed it. The fact is that if one listens to the tape and it's clear from the transcript of the May 23rd tape, that this conversation goes all over the board. It goes from factual analysis to legal analysis to Judge Schweiker and it never has a chronological beginning and an appropriate end. It's one of those jumbled pieces of work that we have, and unfortunately...
Don't you think it would be important for you to listen to the context of your own client's take before you argue whether it's credible or not?
I accepted my co-counsel's recitation to me of what he heard on that day. And they're laughing, and I can understand.
You quoted something from the tape about we don't want you to lie. Well, let me read you that. Ms. Hodge, we don't want you to lie. I'll read you the rest of the page. We're just making up. We're just cracking jokes. If they grant you immunity, then when you get immunity, all we want you to do, if they grant you immunity, we want you to tell the rest of the story, which is the line you're using, which we will say is that you started. You got physical with him first, and you were pushing him in his face, and he was just pushing you off of him in St. Paul. And I can't, well, they can't know that, not because, no, they never know. It's called truth. That's not true. They can't possibly know. Mr. Hodge, and Arnold will be sitting right there in the courtroom listening to your testimony, Mr. Dearcock, and Arnold can sit there and say, Ms. Hodge, Arnold will corroborate anything you say. Mr. Dearcock, Arnold can say, well, I was sitting at this table, I was losing my temper. In other words, they're saying, Arnold will agree with you if you lie. So right after the lie where they say, we're just making a joke, they then go right on and tell her to continue the lie. How do we get away from that? It's in the tape. It's their words, not his counsel's. It's their words.
I absolutely agree with you that that's their words. And the only thing I can tell you is that when Tim Dearo testified under oath before the panel, he indicated that it was never being hurt his intention to tell her the lie. That was not what he was trying to do. He became very frustrated with the entire problem that was laid at his desk, became unwittingly involved in conduct they wanted to impart.
If you want to listen to your client's own tape.
Would it be unreasonable for the panel, having heard that conversation on the tape, would it have been unreasonable for the panel to have believed that your client did urge his client to misrepresent something? That'd be a reasonable conclusion, wouldn't it, or not?
There's no doubt about that.
So then the question becomes, if the panel could conclude that, then the question is, what is the sanction for a lawyer urging a client to lie in a court case, really? This is what's going to be. But pretty serious, isn't it? Or you don't think
there is no doubt that this.
And the whole system depends upon credibility of, and the honesty of witnesses, and particularly lawyers, does it not? I mean, that's, if lawyers lie, what's left of the system? I mean, the fact finders and the people that make judgments don't make very good judgments if lawyers lie to them, or if lawyers tell clients to lie.
You know, I'll say partly in response to what Justice Stratton said, partly in response to you. I cannot and will not stand here and quibble with Your Honor. I was the former chairman of the grievance committee. I understand that. And I think it is important. When we're talking about punishment, we're talking about whether it should be comparable. The tape is what it is. The transcript is what it is. Whether I listened to it or not, I took Mark Holman's factual recitation. I don't think I could apologize for that. It is what it is. It's black and white. The words are there. And I can't argue around that. That's the fact. You're not going to hear me try to say it isn't there. You're not going to hear me try to say that it didn't happen.
Well, I think what I do hear you saying for your client is that whatever the tape says, and it's not quite as direct as we could have, but is that your client testified for the panel and indicated that he did not urge Ms. St. Paul to lie, and that's where we have the difference.
And I certainly accept that that's a credibility issue. If this works down the penalty, what we do in the privacy of our office on a consultation basis, ultimately what the client does, what matters. And obviously no affidavit was executed here, and no testimony was even elicited. It never became an issue whether she made the moral judgment to lie or not. I am not trying to...
So it's okay to advise your client to lie, you don't get in trouble as long as it's okay to advise?
I am not saying that. I'm saying that.
That's the interest you're making.
Yeah, I'm not saying that. I've never done so. I don't intend to do so. Where I'm headed with this, if it comes down to penalty, and the situation is the consultation room, how does that compare to the prosecutor standing up and basically lying in front of the tribunal court? And if 60 days is appropriate there, and that's what we're talking about, why would it not be here? Because no harm to happen before a tribunal, and I recognize this might be slated here, but this is the consultation center.
Thank you, Mr. Rothman. Mr. DeMarco.
Good morning, Your Honors. It pleases the court, Paul DeMarco, former later, Cincinnati Bar Association. I want to pick up on some of the points that Justice Stratton made. The meeting began with the affidavit of May 3rd sitting in front of all three parties. That's what they began to talk about. They began to talk about that affidavit, and they also read the affidavit. And I want you to know what that affidavit said, because it was a reference to the fact it wasn't sequential. It said that Arthur Wilson did, quote, grab me several times, threw a board at me, grabbed me and pushed me. I hit the wall. I was on the floor. He slapped me in the mouth. He called me a dirty bitch. He said if I called the police, I would have a quick divorce. They then turned to Ms. St. Paul. She told the story again. She actually said in telling the story what I said there was true. Then Ms. Haas picks up the story and says her story is perfectly true. Arnold tells the same story, meaning the defendant. Then Tim Dierdorf picks up the affidavit and reads it.
And Arnold is Haas's client, but not Dierdorf's client.
Arnold is Haas's client. She had represented him previously in a gross sexual imposition charge. Yes, she's Haas's. He is Haas's client, the husband of Nori St. Paul, the victim.
And neither of them at this point represent St. Paul.
Neither of them represents St. Paul. There's some discussion later on in the transcript about by Mr. Dierdorf, well, can I represent the victim while you're representing the defendant since I'm your partner? And tellingly, the way they resolve that is they say, well, because, Ms. Haas says, because of your political connections with Judge Schweikert, maybe you ought to come to court. So the way they're trying to get around this obvious conflict of interest is to have Mr. Dierdorf come in front of Judge Schweikert and exert his political influence. Hence our allegation that they were implying to Ms. St. Paul the ability to influence a judge, which is a violation of DR 9101C.
But going back again to the transcript, which now nobody can deny,
right,
that it was said by the parties, in the transcript they do talk to their credit about getting waivers of conflict of interest of their clients, with their clients both agreeing to the representation. So if they do in fact get waivers, that conflict would be cured.
I'm not sure that's a waivable conflict if it's a concurrent situation like that. But be that as it may, when Dierdorf takes the May 3rd affidavit in hand, he too says, so everything in this affidavit is true. Then shortly after that comes the passage where that you were quoting, and he says, she says, Nori St. Paul says to him, is there anything I can say? And his response is, you can say you started the fight and he can claim self-defense. Now, that is very telling because she has, up to that point, as you pointed out, never mentioned anything about I pushed him first. So this is all coming from Mr. Dierdorf, the idea that Ms. St. Paul started the fight. Well, even if he perhaps had misheard something in the telling of the story, and even if we lay aside the fact that he looked at the affidavit and he said the affidavit is true, then you come to toward the end. And the other passage that you quoted, where she says, well, if I tell this story that I push him first, they aren't going to know that that's not true. And Ms. Haas, as if this is the beauty of the whole scene, says, no, they can't possibly know. And then she says, just to reassure her that it's okay for her to get up and tell this lie, she says, Arnold will be sitting there and he'll corroborate everything you say. Well, you know, if you're asking a witness to tell the truth, you don't need to guarantee the witness that there will be instant corroboration no matter what she says. So I think when Mr. Deardorff takes the position that he was confused as to the story, I think that is disingenuous to the extent that what he knew of the events is on tape. We know what he knew, and there is no question when you listen to the tape, and I think I've listened to it 25 or 30 times, there is no question that there was never any mention that she started the fight. She made the first physical contact until Mr. Deardorff brought it up. And in fact, we had Mr. Wilson testify at our hearing, and I asked him, did you make the first physical contact? No. Were you in fear of her making physical contact, that she was going to come at you?
But counsel, in every conversation with your client, you're determining what happened, and aren't things always suggested? Are you sure that this didn't happen? Are you sure that what you saw is what you saw? Could it have been this? Isn't it possible that this happened? I mean, that's an everyday occurrence with a lawyer and client trying to figure out what exactly did happen. Isn't that true?
Your Honor, witness preparation goes on every day.
Sure.
What you're saying does constitute legitimate witness preparation.
I mean, you suggest things and they'll say, no, that isn't what happened. You say, are you sure that isn't it possibly could have happened? Well, it might have. I mean, this is conversations with clients take various forms in trying to get the truth of the matter so you best can represent them. Why look on the sinister side of it like you do?
Because I don't believe this was a search for the truth, at least not after the point where Mr. Deardorff suggested to her that she could say she started the fight. And let me read to you why I don't think he was searching for the truth.
Fine.
Both of these lawyers, at the end of the conversation, Ms. Haas says, once you're granted immunity, you can say any goddamn thing you want. Mr. Deardorff says, you can say that, you can elaborate on the whole story. You can tell them Santa Claus was there. Mr. Deardorff says, what we're saying is you can lie through your teeth. Ms. Haas says, once you're granted immunity, there's no way in hell you could be arrested for anything, and you can tell any goddamn story you want.
Had she been granted immunity?
No, they were suggesting to her, when she said, what can I say? And Mr. Deardorff said, well, you can say you started the fight. She said, wait a minute. They're going to charge me with domestic violence then. And he said, no, don't worry. In order to get you to testify, they'll have to grant you immunity. And that's when you can say anything you want. And that's this notion of the rest of the story. The idea was that she would get immunity to testify, and then she could tell the rest of the story. The rest of the story being, you started the fight, or I'm saying Paul started the fight.
So you feel that in listening to the entire conversation, you can determine that they were out to have her do one set of things, and they were molding her into this lying the entire time that they had this conversation.
Well, while they're having the conversation with her, they did suggest a number of options, and some of those options are the subject of other alleged violations. They said at one point Ms. Haas suggested it would be a good idea if you take a vacation for a month so they can't subpoena you in violation, we believe, of DR-7102A6. So the suggestion, it was one of many suggestions that they made, but it was the strategy that they settled on. If you listen to the tape, they come to the end of the tape, and both lawyers bless the strategy. Ms. Haas says it's a perfect strategy. Mr. Deardorff says, okay, so that's what we're going to do. this idea that you're going to testify under immunity and you're going to say what we want you to say. You're going to say anything you want.
Let's go back to the first telephone conversation. What precipitated her in reporting that telephone conversation?
That's what I can't understand.
She testified to that. There was a suggestion by opposing counsel that she testified. She did testify. She was called by the panel. That's one of the issues that is raised by the other side. She said, the reason I began being suspicious of her and I was taping her is what she had done to me in regard to the gross sexual imposition charge. Ms. Haas, according to the witness, had talked Ms. St. Paul into dropping the gross sexual imposition charge. This was a charge that related to alleged improper touching by Mr. Wilson of Ms. St. Paul's daughter. This was before they were married. She brought her sexual imposition charge.
So she had a prior experience.
She had a prior bad experience. She testified very, very emotionally that Ms. Haas had called her over and over and over to get her to drop that charge. She didn't want that to happen again. She didn't think anyone would believe her if she said, this woman is trying to get me to lie. This woman is trying to bribe a judge. So she took it upon herself to record that first conversation. She took that tape to the Cincinnati Police Division. They wired her for the second conversation. There was also a suggestion that this is a credibility contest. I think what that comes down to is it's Mr. Deardorff's credibility versus the tape. This case is made very simple by the fact that the violations we're talking about are preserved on tape. The last thing that I wanted to address was the sanction. The suggestion was made that this took place in the sanctity of a lawyer's office, and I don't know if the opposing counsel meant to suggest it was okay to lie or to encourage a witness to lie that's in your own office. We certainly don't think it's ever appropriate, and no case that this court has ever handed down has suggested such a thing. But I want to take it a step further. What was he really asking this woman to do? Remember, at the beginning of this conversation, they all three settled on the fact that this man would be convicted of domestic violence if she testified, that he was guilty. And so what she was asking this victim of domestic violence to do was not just to say that her abuser was not guilty of domestic violence. By getting her to say she started physical contact, they actually wanted her to implicate herself in domestic violence. And the only thing that they gave her to suggest she could do this with impunity was the hope that she'd be given immunity and wouldn't be prosecuted for it. I think this is an egregious offense. Telling a victim of domestic violence that you should go before a court and pretend not just that you weren't a victim of domestic violence when we all know you were, but that you actually were violent with your husband. That, we believe, justifies the full sanction that was recommended by the panel. Now, the panel...
Did she ever give that indication, though, to anybody? What about the law clerk who prepared the affidavit?
When you say, Justice Douglas, did she ever give, do you mean Ms. St. Paul?
Ms. St. Paul.
He never talked, the law clerk never talked to her. He only talked to Ms. Haas, and he said he took his direction from Ms. Haas, which I think is why his draft affidavit suggested that the May 3rd affidavit was false. Even after both attorneys had said that the May 3rd affidavit was true during the May 23rd conversation. So Ms. Haas had gone to him after the May 23rd conversation and said, do up this affidavit and this is what I should say.
So when he says that he drafted the affidavit from information that he understood, it was not from the client, but was from, or not from Ms. St. Paul, but it was from his own immediate supervisors.
Right, it was from neither the victim nor the defendant, Your Honor. The last thing I want to say about sanctions, the panel appealed back the recommended sanction from 1 year to 6 months and offered no reason for doing so. I want to note that the panel's finding, the board's finding, said that Mr. Dierdorf has the feeling, quote, Mr. Dierdorf has the feeling he's been fairly prosecuted in this matter. As far as he is concerned, he was not involved and he did not do anything wrong. And the panel went on to find otherwise. Under those circumstances in which he has expressed absolutely no remorse for what he did, I do not believe that it is appropriate for the board to peel back that suspension without good reason. And I don't think there was good reason suggested by the record. As Chief Justice Moore pointed out, there are character references in there, but none of the character witnesses for Mr. Dierdorf had listened to the tape, as this court has. None of them had tried to account for the things that he said on there. After all, this court is punishing him not for the sort of person he is, good or bad. It is punishing him for what he did. And it is clear from the tape what he did. His character witnesses cannot change that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. DeMarco. Mr. Rosenhofer, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
I appreciate it, Curtis. I'll try to make it that quick. This is a very highly publicized incident since I had the tape broadcast on the TV media. It's clear from listening to the tape that the attorneys have no real understanding of immunity in the state statutory degree when a judge does, the common police judge doesn't understand that. So there would need to be some time to get the facts together.
Arnold Wilson at page 247 of the hearing transcript indicated that Murray was the aggressor in this incident, and Murray St. Paul indicated in her testimony, the first testimony I cited to you, Murray St. Paul, 365, that it didn't seem like Tim had any grip on what the facts were while I was there. And lastly, I think Justice Sweeney has actually hit upon an important thing. Tim was the one from the outset concerned about the deadliness of the situation.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.